morning, U.S. versus Sanchez. Sachs.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. May it please the Court, Joshua Sachs for Appellant Edwin Sanchez. The question on this criminal appeal is whether the district court improperly imposed on Mr. Sanchez a two-level guideline enhancement for maintaining what a drug house or a stash house, an enhancement which increased his minimum guideline sentence from 210 months to a minimum of 262 months. So this is a case where the district court hewed closely to the guidelines. He looked carefully, looked for any reason he could find that might justify going outside the guidelines. He didn't find one. He took the guidelines as telling him where to go on this case. And he went with the low end. But because he gave Mr. Sanchez this two-level enhancement, the sentence was 262 months rather than the 210 months that would have been the low end of the guidelines without it. Now, the problem with the there are two problems with imposing the drug house enhancement in this case. I can deal with them both. The first one is it is, or it would be, I think, certainly in any other circuit than this, and I think here too, it's an ex post facto statute. The second problem is that even if it does apply, Mr. Sanchez doesn't qualify under the drug house enhancement. But let me address the ex post facto problem, as I don't think there's any question that if the guidelines were still mandatory, as they were under Booker, I don't believe the government is contesting, I may be mistaken, that this would be an ex post facto increase. The offense charged.
In Demery, the government actually argued in agreement with the defense that it was an ex post facto problem.
I think so. And I think there are two questions here. One is, even under Demery, our position is, Demery at first blush might seem to suggest that there can never be an ex post facto law when you're dealing with the advisory guidelines, but I don't think that's the case. Normally, your guideline will increase the punishment for the same conduct, and this is not a matter of this does not invoke a notice problem. It doesn't invoke what Judge Posner and Demery referred to as blindsiding the defendant. The problem in this case is that the change in the guideline really made something illegal that was not illegal at the time of the offense. Mr. Sanchez got this increase because he was dealing drugs out of his premises, out of his house, rather than down at the street corner or out of a truck or out of somebody else's property. It was a criminalization of conduct that had not been, I won't say it hadn't been criminal before, it had not been any kind of an enhancement before. And because he wasn't on notice, I think even under Demery, this is an ex post facto law. As far as Demery itself, I understand this court has stayed with the Demery position for, I think it's been 6 years now. I don't think there's been any but the slightest hint in one of the cases that I cited that the court might consider rethinking Demery. But I'd like to make this suggestion. Demery has not been accepted in any other circuit, and it has been, the thinking of Demery has been rejected by every other circuit that has actually come to a decision on the issue. Whether Demery was rightly decided or not, and I think you might say that if you concentrate on the inherent logic of the decision, Demery may have been correctly decided. But the other circuits have preferred to focus on the practical implications. The purpose of the guidelines, even now that the guidelines are advisory rather than mandatory, is to look for uniformity in sentencing.
Does the ex post facto clause, in your view, prohibit a district court from taking into account a proposed amendment to the sentencing guidelines?
I think the district court can take anything into account. I think that once the guideline is adopted and the court, at least at the first stage of analysis, has to make that the baseline, then I think that the ex post facto issue is invoked. I think it is not invoked in the situation you asked about.
So if it's a proposed amendment, the district court can say, sounds like pretty good advice to me, I'm going to follow it. But if the sentencing proceeding is 2 months after the sentencing amendment has been adopted, it can't follow it.
The district court cannot use the proposed amendment as an enhancement in calculating the guideline level. It certainly can,
just in deciding what
under 3553A, in its discretion, use the reasoning of the proposed amendment in the discretionary portion of the sentence. Yes, I believe
so. So why is the difference of constitutional magnitude?
Because we distinguish between the first step, the legal determination of what the guideline level is, which is reviewed de novo. Only after that baseline is established do we go on to the discretionary part, which of course is reviewed by this court in the most deferential way. There are two different steps, and I hope that answers the question. The constitutional problem applies to the first stage.
Well, would you agree that the district court is free to say, in essence, okay, here's I'm calculating the guidelines, but you know, they really don't adequately take into account the seriousness of the harm. For example, it seems to me an aggravating circumstance that the defendant was storing and dealing drugs out of his home where his family lived, and that put them at a greater risk. I think that's an aggravating circumstance, so I'm going to impose a higher sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. The district court can do that, and that's reviewed as an abuse of discretion.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm into my rebuttal time. If the court has any questions at
this point. You'd like to stop now? You can save it.
I'm sorry. I will save my rebuttal time. Sir? Yes, sir.
May it please the court. Good morning. Michelle Peterson for the United States. The defendant's argument is clearly foreclosed by Demery, which is settled case law in our circuit that the ex post facto clause just simply is not implicated in the application of advisory guidelines.
And as for the facts here, though, it strikes me that there's nothing particularly unusual about what Mr. Sanchez was doing here. I understand dealing drugs and so forth in multi-kilo quantities, but drop-offs and pickups at his house. How does that become maintaining that premises for that purpose? His family's living there. What was shown to the district judge to show that it met the requirements or met the sense of the guideline?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think that where the defendant, Mr. Sanchez, differs from other defendants is the extent to which he was using that premises in his drug dealing activity. There are plenty of drug dealers who get delivery of the drugs.
Virtually all. I mean, when you look at search warrants, they say there's kind of a presumption that a drug dealer keeps drug-related things in their home and so forth.
I think many drug dealers probably have incidental contact with their home. Maybe they bring home some of the drugs that didn't sell at the end of the day, or it might be that they're at their home and they get a phone call to go out and meet a customer. Those types of things are not what's contemplated by the guideline. The guideline contemplates the home has to be used as a principal or primary use of that premises has to be the drug dealing activity. And in this case, the district court at sentencing found that not only was the defendant supplied drugs by his supplier at his home on a number of occasions, but that is also where he paid his supplier. And in fact, the defendant himself, in the defendant's version of the offense that he submitted to probation, admitted that he received drugs in the home and that he would store drugs in the attic to help conceal them.
Was there any showing that this particular house was selected because it was a good drop-off venue, or that it was prepared in some special way with a hidden compartment for the storage of drugs, it was easy to get to, or anything of that nature?
No, Your Honor, other than the defendant's admission that he would store drugs in the attic because he was trying to conceal them.
Is there any indication of how often drugs were received or distributed from the house?
There was no specific finding as to the number of drug deliveries to the house. However, both the defendant and the government agreed that there was sort of an escalating pattern of conduct, that at first the defendant took small deliveries, 2 or 3 kilograms.
Relatively speaking.
2 or 3 kilograms until his supplier could trust him, and then he started taking larger deliveries, 20 to 40 kilograms. So it's clear that it was not a one-time occasion. It was sort of a pattern that developed over time.
Over about 2 years. Let me ask you. I think it was Judge Capalla in the Ortiz decision interpreted this guideline, which, frankly, it's new. It hasn't had that much interpretation yet. And in the Ortiz case, he drew on our precedents interpreting 21 U.S.C. 856. Do you think that's an appropriate way to interpret the guideline?
I think that may be an appropriate way to interpret the guideline, and I think that the distinction that was made in the defendant's brief is not as applicable in this case, because while 856 talks about leasing, renting, using, and maintaining the premises, all of that is contemplated in this guideline as well, even though it just says maintain when you look to the application mm-hmm. note. And I think the distinction between this case and Ortiz is that in the Ortiz case, the court found that the application, this enhancement did not apply because the premises was only used on one occasion, mm-hmm. where in this case it's used repeatedly to both receive drugs and to make drug payments.
Did customers come to the house?
Yes. In the defendant's sentencing memorandum, he in fact admitted that his co-defendant would meet with potential drug customers at the house on some occasions. So not only is the house a recipient point for the drugs, but customers are coming to the house. So taking all these facts into account, the district court did not clearly err in finding that this premises was one of its principal uses was drug distribution.
Do we know how long drugs were stored at the house?
We do not know how long drugs were stored at the house.
He was in the business 2 years?
Yes, Your Honor. At least 2 years. I mean,
2 years in. At least, as far as we know, $2.5 million was, is that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What was the amount of income he received from the house?
I believe it's stated in the brief. I don't recall off the top of my head, but it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the district court specifically made a finding as to the amount of money on page 20 of the sentencing transcript. Seeing no further questions, respectfully request that the sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Counsel. Mr. Sachs. You have 2 minutes, Mr. Sachs.
The government, with all respect, is reading way too much into some rather cryptic observations in the PSR and from the defendant's statement. I don't think there's any question that at least sometimes the defendant did use the house for drug deals. But we don't know whether this happened on a few occasions, whether this was his constant practice. I think there was enough information brought out that maybe the government should have pushed further on it, tried to nail it down. I think an inference was raised. I don't think it was sufficient to justify the enhancement. As far as the Demery case, as I was indicating before, uniformity is important, even under the advisory guidelines. And whether Demery was rightly decided or wrongly decided, I think it's in the interests of sentencing uniformity that all the circuits approach this issue from the same point of view. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. And you took this case by appointment, did you not?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have the thanks of the court for your fine representation of your client. Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement. We